Well, see, the last time you were here...
Sir.
Looking at my voluminous files, it's on the occasion of First Among Equals.
That's 5 years ago.
It's a long time ago. Before we got our computers, which is why I just...
Oh, and it's the Paley still ran the world.
Yeah, that's why I just have clippings and press releases and things like that. But you haven't been resting on your laurels.
No, sir.
No.
You wouldn't want me to do that, would you?
No, I wouldn't. No, that would deprive the world of a lot of entertainment.
Quite right.
So give us a little summary of what's been going on over the last 5 years.
What's happened the last 5 years? Well, I've written a play. I've written 2 books, a set of short stories, and the latest book, As the Crow Flies. And more recently, I've been involved in running a concert, or indeed a campaign, for the Kurdish refugees, which culminated in a concert this weekend in the United States from Wembley to raise money for those refugees who are caught in the hills and are unwilling to return to their homeland or indeed even to the enclaves for fear of being killed by Saddam Hussein. They've been told too often that they will be all right if they come back, and they no longer believe it.
Wasn't that interesting? I had no idea. How did that... You said it was a concert.
Yes, it was an amazing situation. April 15th, just a few weeks ago, about a month ago, my 16-year-old son and I were watching those people coming out of Zakhau into the hills.
Yeah.
And he said, "You ought to do something, Dad," or "We ought to do something." And I said, "Well, I think governments are working to do something." He said, "No, I think something where the people can be involved." And I said, "Well, it's not that easy because this is a crisis situation. This is not like Live Aid, for example, where you have 3 or 4 months to prepare for it." He said, "Well, at least you could try." So I rang Sir Paul Fox, the managing director of the BBC, and said, "If I asked you to wipe 5 hours off the network in 3 Sundays' time, how would you feel?" He said, "Yep, for that cause we'd do it." And he wiped 5 hours off. I then went off to the Red Cross because I thought it was terribly important that the money went to the right person. But because when people give money, they must see that it goes to someone who's capable of spending it competently. And we knew the Red Cross were in the area, and that they had already building field hospitals and moving in tents and water purification plants. I then went to a man called Harvey Goldsmith and asked if he could put together the talent. I'd got Christaberg, I'd run Christaberg, and he'd agreed, and asked him to put the rest together, and he did. And then I ran the 3 of them, and it culminated in a concert at Wembley, which was attended by Princess Diana, Princess of Wales, and the Prime Minister, the Leader of the Opposition, and the Leader of the Liberal Party, all attended. And it went on 5 hours, and we were attempting to raise £10 million. The government gave me £10 million to start off with, so we got the 10 straight away, and we turned that into 20. Then we discovered it was going to 34 countries, and probably 400 million people. So we decided to up it again. It mushroomed. And we don't know yet, of course, because it only ended last Sunday, what the final figure will be. The campaign ends on May the 25th. And I think we'll be able to tell the world how much we've raised probably around the middle of June.
So these funds will be channeled to the Red Cross.
And the Red Cross. In England, we asked everybody to send £5
mm-hmm.
to the Red Cross. In America, we're asking everybody to send £10 to the American Red Cross
mm-hmm.
because they're out there as well and they're doing wonderful work and deserve to be supported.
Now, who broadcast the concert in the U.S.?
MTV. One of the disadvantages, of course, we had with the United States.
I remember that now, but I didn't realize that you were behind that.
Yes, that was my concert. I wish it had been CBS who'd done it, but of course you can't wipe the network in America as easily as you can in Great Britain, which is understandable, but sad.
I guess you were able to take advantage of some of your Tory contacts.
I think my son summed it up more wisely when he said, someone said, "I was shocked you could put on a show like that in 18 days, and he said, "But it's taken 20 years of contacts and knowledge to be able to pick up a phone to the 6 people who can make things work, and every one of them answers the phone, and every one of them says yes. I'd have taken a lot longer if I'd been at university."
Is it all right to use the phrase Tory?
Yes.
I remember many years...
Slightly disparaging.
Well, 20 years ago, I was writing a newscast, and I turned in some copy to the news editor, and I was writing about the Tory government, and I was severely chastised. Saying, no, you shouldn't say that. You should say the Conservative government. And so from that point on, I got a little nervous about using the term Tory.
I think Tory for the Conservatives and Socialist for the Labour both consider those terms slightly derogatory. I will always talk about them as Socialists, and they always talk about us as Tories. But you're right, the main word is Conservative and Labour, and both sides would rather have their own side described that way. Yes, it is very slight, because it's old-fashioned, too. It gives an impression of the last century of Whigs and Tories. So, yes, there's a bit of that as well.
I think we had some Whigs and Tories in the U.S.
You
for a while.
You certainly did, sir. What a grand lot they were. They should never have let the colonies go, but that's the way it is.
Now, you mentioned that you'd written a play. I think in some of the publicity material from HarperCollins, it states that you have your own theatre.
I've bought a controlling interest in the most beautiful theatre called The Playhouse, which is on the corner of Northumberland Avenue, and I have the great honour currently to have Sir Peter Hall, arguably the greatest director in the world at the moment. He's currently doing Twelfth Night, and it'll be followed by Tennessee Williams' The Rose Tattoo with Julie Walters. So we're playing to wonderful houses, and at a time when theatres are not doing very well, it's surviving. It isn't doing much better than surviving. I understand in the United States that in New York there's a terrible theatre problem, especially for plays. And we've got a bit of that in England. It's not an easy time for theatre.
Not an easy time for publishing in England, too. I was reading that there are tremendous layoffs in the publishing industry there. What's going on?
Three of the major houses have been, if not four, have been sacking about 15% of their staff. They've been losing money continually, and the good old family tradition, they've been keeping everybody on because they've been with them for so long. And suddenly the bankers have said, well, if you go on doing that, you'll be bankrupt. My own house, Hodder and Stoughton, have sacked 100 people from a workload of 700. I brought it down to 600, and they may even bring it down lower. It's because they haven't been making a profit now for the last 3 years on a turnover of 60 million. So it's rather sad, but it's happening across the industry. Not just one company, not just the one I happen to be involved in, but right across the industry.
They need a Charlie Trumper to get involved there, huh?
It needs a Charlie Trumper. Quite right. Needs someone of energy, vision, and skill. Quite right.
Tell me about Charlie Trumper. Who is Charlie Trumper?
Charlie Trumper's the hero of my next book, or the main character in my next book.
Your current book.
My current book, I suppose you must call it now, yes. My current book, now that it's already on the bestsellers list.
Yes, and it hasn't even been published yet.
It's not officially published, and it's already 3 in Los Angeles and 6 in New York and 1 in Canada. It's got into the shops just, but it's had 3 crits already that have said it's better than Cain and Abel, which I think is the reason it's running out of the shops. Charlie is born in the East End of London. He's the grandson of a costermonger, I think what you call a street trader, a vendor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really all he wants to do. He wants to work on the barrow and sell apples and pears. But his grandfather has other plans for him. He wants him to be educated. He wants him to strike out and do bigger things, but the boy doesn't. And by the age of 11, the grandfather says, look, you're better already than I am. You should strike out. He says, no, I just want to have your barrow. And he, by the age of 14, he's got 3 barrows and a corner shop. But he goes off to that First World War, that terrible cauldron of the First World War, and during that period in his life, his whole life changes. And when he returns to the East End of London, he takes one look at it, turns his back, and he only travels 3-4 miles as the crow flies. But of course it's from the east of London to the west of London, where he gets hold of one little shop in a massive block, and he decides that day that one day he'll own every single shop on the block. And then he'll build the biggest barrow in the world.
It doesn't come quite that easily, because there is a villain in this story who runs all the way through this book. Tell me about the villain, or villains, actually.
Villains,
too.
Because yeah. It's the family, of course. He comes across a Captain Trentham when he's in the trenches, who is a coward and a miscreant. And Captain Trentham dominates his life, as does his mother, the evil Mrs. Ethel Trentham, who strides through the pages trying to make sure that Charlie never can make the next step forward. And between them, they do everything in their power to stop him actually building the biggest barrow in the world. But Charlie is not a man who given in easily to adversity.
No, and Charlie, there, no matter how educated he might become, or erudite, and no matter what challenges he's been able to overcome, there are things, baggage that he carries with him. For example, his accent. Tell me about that.
Well, I suppose in England in those days, much less now, it's a terrible disadvantage to have an East End accent. How are you, my duck, stucky? How are you? Love you like a couple of potatoes and a pear and a bun. Were you, my dear? Well, that's 4 and threepence. You're unlikely to become the main newsreader at the BBC with such an accent. Indeed, one will remember in those days at the BBC, people who read the news on the radio wore a DJ and bow tie. that was the way it was in those days, and he has to come through all of that. Nowadays, it's actually an advantage to have some form of accent on the BBC. It's now looked upon as not only acceptable, but advisable.
That's, they all sound like Australians.
That's, you that could be right, too. What a terrible insult, sir. You may not come back here. Mm. And so Charlie fights through all of that, but of course there's real ability. Man has been born with real ability and a real brain and fights all of that and has to conquer. You're quite right, the Mrs. Trenthams of this world, who really don't think they should have to mix with people who come from the East End of London and sell off a barrow. Good heavens, what next? They don't like that sort of thing. And that's the old snobby Britain, and I bring it right up to date to the modern Britain. And one must remember now that we have a Prime Minister who left school at 16. And indeed, he himself had to fight up from that sort of background. He once said on television, he said it to me once, but he also said it once on television, you know, Geoffrey, from where I was born to number 10 Downing Street is about 3 to 4 miles.
There's Le Crow flies.
Flies. I was very touched. He said it on television again, which was even kinder of him.
Well, probably As the Crow Flies is your most complex book in terms of structure, because you're dealing not only in the first person but the third person, and you have at least a dozen different characters who become narrators. Tell me about how this developed.
Well, that was a challenge. I do believe every writer should press themselves a little bit more than they did the last time. And as you say, the story moves through 13 pairs of eyes who see it. First Charlie, who sees it as a young man, and then Becky, the next-door neighbour who he hates, gives her version of what she saw. And then you move on to the Colonel, to Daphne first, and Daphne, who shares a room with Becky, says how she saw it. And then the story moves on again, and then the Colonel comes in and says how... So each person moves the story along. But the real challenge in each section, and there are 13 sections of the book, was to make the first chapter of each section the first person. So you had it direct from Charlie's lips, how he believed it happened, and then into the third person to move the story along. And then Becky tells you exactly how she saw it, and she didn't see Charlie the way Charlie saw himself. And then she moves the story on, and then Daphne, this upper-class girl who's going to marry a duke, she sees it totally different from the other two. And that gave me a way of moving the story along through different people. And I hope it was a challenge to make a new idea for a story. And of course I worried about it, because you do see it through 13 people's eyes. And the hard thing of all, of course, was having the voice or ear of the human being you were dealing with. The Colonel can't be the same as Charlie. Charlie can't be the same as Mrs. Trentham. Mrs. Trentham can't be the same as Becky. And you've got to, when you hear them speaking, believe that's the sort of things they'd say in the way they would say it. They mustn't all sound the same. So it was, as you rightly say, a difference and a hell of a challenge. In fact, it took 19 drafts, and it took 2.5 years to do, and every one of them handwritten. I was so determined to make it work.
What do you mean by a draft? Are you talking about the entire manuscript
beginning
as a draft?
19 times. That book took 1,500 hours. When people say, it reads so quickly, Geoffrey, it reads so smoothly, I can assure you, it's hour upon hour upon hour, sometimes fighting over one sentence.
See, nobody's standing behind you saying, do this. It's something you have to do on your own.
That is the strange thing about self-discipline as opposed to discipline. Now, there are the two disciplines. I like both of them. There's the one where the commanding officer comes in and says, Archer, I need the following done by 4 o'clock. Do it. I find that very easy, because you just go out and do it. If Margaret Thatcher tells you to do something, you do it. If John Major tells you to do something, you do it. And you report back and say, there it is, sir. A, B, C, D. Done, sir. Next. And he sends you off again. That, actually, I find that's one sort of discipline. And actually, it's the easy one. The harder one is to get up at 7 every morning, start writing for 2 hours, take an hour's break and write 2 more hours, light lunch, an hour's break, 2 more hours, an hour's break, 2 more hours, bed, 45 days running without ever shirking one of them. That's self-discipline, and you've got to tell yourself to do it. There are 1,000 reasons not to write a book. There are 1,000 ways of walking around a table. I really ought to go and get the shopping. Oh, I said I'd pick up my children from school. I did promise I'd ring my mother. Oh, I must take the car into the... Oh, there's 100,000 reasons why not to write a book. But to actually sit down and go once upon a time and stick it out and stay there and let nothing stop you doing it is a different type of discipline.
Well, I just got back from Houston, Texas, and I carried your novel with me. They could have made it a smaller book, you know. carrying this and all my Walkman tapes and everything on an airplane wasn't the easiest thing. But one of the things I really liked about it was the pace. I mean, it was of a book that, as you mentioned, it took 19 drafts and thousands of hours to write, but for the reader, it's a long book, but it's yeah. fast. And toward the ending, the last chapters are absolutely harrowing. The wonderful chapters of Charlie trying to beat the deadline to save his empire. And it was just the kind of thing that you just didn't want to stop. And another interesting thing is that in the novel, Charlie actually comes full circle. Tell me about that.
Yes, I think most of us in life probably want to go full cycle, and it's very kind of you to say that it has that pace, and I think I like to believe that's what Cain and Abel had, and it keeps you reading the whole time, you can't stop it. But turning the full circle, this book is based on real human beings, and you can't write this sort of book and just make it up. It's based on a man called Sir Jack Cohen, who had a barrow in the East End of London in 1900 and went on to run 157 grocery shops in London. Marcus Seif of the great Marks and Spencers, and Lord Forty, Charlie Forty, who runs Trust House Forty, all the big hotels. Talking to them over the years, listening to their stories of what it was like to be an immigrant, what it was like to be fighting to get through, what it was like to be Jewish, what it was like to do all those things, had to get into the book. But one of those three, told me that in the end all he wanted to do was go back and run a little barrow, because he'd got all these shops. And he said, when I was president of the company, I was always going to board meetings. They were always putting sheets of white paper on me covered in figures that I didn't understand. I never saw a customer. I never touched anyone. He said, I used to love it, Jeffrey. He said, the most unhappy moment in my life was when I went from 3 barrows to 4 barrows. Because 3 barrows I could get from one to the other all day, and I could say, hello, Mrs. Smith, how are you? How's the son? Is he all right? Is he still at school? Is he good? You got some apples? Well, you know he likes the grapes. He needs the grapes, doesn't he, my love? And he said, that's what he missed. He was sitting around a board meeting saying, well, the figures this year are 42 million turnover, 3,800,000 profit. And he said, that was impressive and important, but it didn't touch human beings. And I suppose I'm the same in a way, because that's why I remain in politics. I mean, I love, most of all, I mean, I went up to Liverpool last week in England. I had breakfast at Frank's Cape, and if you're ever in Liverpool, by the way, Frank's Cape is the best egg and jam butty, if you know what an egg and jam butty is up here. That's an egg between two great big pieces of bread with jam. Absolutely wonderful. And Frank has an opinion on everything, because he's been running Frank's Cape on the corner of the docks for 30 years, so there's nothing, there's no opinion he hasn't gotten, the Conservative government, the Labour government. And I always report it back to the Prime Minister. I always say, or I go on a trawler with 17 fishermen and listen to them, and I report about, I've seen Frank, sir, and he says, who's Frank? I said, Frank runs this restaurant on the corner of Liverpool. Now, what he says is wrong with this government. And let him know what people know. Of course, he goes out a lot himself. So that contact with human beings has always been important to me, and will always be, actually touching real people who tell you real things. And I think sometimes it's easy, and it may well have happened to Margaret Thatcher when she became a world leader, a leader of world stature, that less and less she had time, it wasn't her fault, less and less she had time to go out to real people and listen to what they were saying, because that's your strength as a politician. And I believe it's your strength as a writer. When you write, you've touched real people, and you can put them into a book. You know, Dickens' greatest strength, my wife always says, is the minor characters. They're all irrelevant. If you look at the minor characters in a Dickensian book, they're irrelevant, but they're wonderful. You're desperate to cling on and see what they do, and they don't do anything. It's the major characters, as in any story, who take the story through. And that's because Dickens mixed in the East End of London with real people.
Well, I'm somewhat surprised now that you have reached your middle age, that you still have...
Good God, sir, I'm 51.
Well, it's younger than I am. But you still have this... I can see it when you were younger, perhaps, but you still have this infatuation for politics. Why, when you can have something like this and hold it in your hand and say, this I have achieved, and I put this on a shelf, and I'm reaching millions of people around the world.
It's strange, isn't it? I think human beings probably always want something they haven't got. And if I was a cabinet minister, I would want to be someone who'd written a book that would be number one on the New York Times bestsellers list. I think it's a restlessness that makes one want to do something one hadn't done. And indeed, in the concert for the Kurds, I was very aware of the challenge in 18 days of mounting that sort of operation, the adrenaline pumping and the whole organization, and found that tremendous. And I suppose I am a restless, driven person and would not deny it. And frankly, the answer to your question is, that is not enough to be able to take the book off the shelf, hand it to you with, dare I say, some degree of pride, and say, I hope you'll enjoy this. That's not enough, sir, and it never will be.
I would assume that many would-be politicians, though, have a quest for power. This is what they really want.
Oh, but there's nothing wrong with power, as long as you achieve something. Power for power's sake is a total, complete, and utter waste of time, and is for little men and women of no significance. If you have power, you should use it. I've never forgotten, we had a great politician in our country called Ian MacLeod, who tragically died when living in number 11 Downing Street, where the Chancellor of the Exchequer lives. I remember in a great Tory party speech he said, in front of 5,000 people who went into total silence and shock, "I want power!" The whole place went, because we were in opposition then, the whole place went absolutely silent. "We need power!" And the whole place was, now they were trying to get out of the room to pretend they weren't in the same room. He suddenly raised his hands and said, "In order that we can serve." And the whole place rose in one. And if you don't do it for that reason, if you don't desire power in order that you can serve, well, then there is no purpose in it at all, in my view.
Well, here in the United States, I'm sure this is not the case in Britain, but we have a lot of sleazy politicians who have their hands out and who find themselves in the federal penitentiary on frequent occasions.
Yes, but...
Are you looking their names up?
I was going to look up something in the book which referred to that. No, I won't. It isn't time, so I apologize. Yes, I hear what you say, but the other side of that coin is that you also have some very fine men.
Oh, that's true.
I mean, I had the privilege of being at Oxford with Bill Bradley,
mm-hmm.
a man who has served this country from the day he returned to it, and could have made a lot of money and been very successful indeed not going into politics, but always wanted to serve, always wanted to do something worthwhile. And you, thank God, still have a lot of people like that. Now, one of the problems you face, if I may dare to say so, Don, in your country, if I may dare to say so, is that there are opportunities in this country to make money as a politician. You have this system where you're allowed to go to the Senate or to Congress and not exactly bribe people, but help their campaign funds if they will back one bill or back another bill. You can't do that in England. You have to declare every single company you're involved in. You have to declare anything you are personally involved in. If you don't, you can be thrown out of the House of Commons. The pay is lousy. It's currently $40,000 a year. Pay is absolutely dreadful, and people go on doing it. And I can tell you that we have a cabinet now, the 17 most important people in the country from a political point of view, who between them couldn't rub two beans together. I mean, they're all poor men. And they do not go off and make side deals that will get them into a penitentiary. They'd be caught very easily indeed. And that's the strength of our country. Now, one of our strengths is that we don't allow, and I hope we never will allow, to spend a lot of money on getting yourself elected. The moment you can't spend more than $5,000 getting yourself elected, and you are not allowed to take advertising on television. I do wish sometimes that people would realize that the world is not run by CBS, NBC, and ABC.
It's not?
No, it is not. In fact, I have long believed in this particular country that if the Lord were to make a second coming, CBS would demand that it was in prime time.
Well, Geoffrey Archer, you certainly have had a colorful career. Have you? A lot of it has been reflected in your fiction. Have you ever thought about the nonfiction you
Don, know? You may be a frightfully old man, and indeed you may have aged since I last saw you,
I have.
All I know. But I, sir, am a young man, and will not be writing my biography, or autobiography, for at least another 20 years. And I certainly, as you were kind enough to say, I had done many things in the last 5 years, I shall do many more in the next 20, and there will be several novels and several other things in between. So don't be asking me now, or when I come to see you in 5 years' time, Don, any more silly questions about writing an autobiography, because I have other things to achieve, sir.
Well, it's great talking to you. I remember vividly the last interview I did with you, and it's interesting that you are here at the same time the Queen is visiting.
A wild coincidence, sir.
Yeah. My wife's brother is a Secret Service agent who was assigned to help protect the Queen when she got here, and she told me several weeks ago, she said, Don, she said, the Queen is coming, the Queen is coming. And I said, which one? And she said, well, we only have one Queen.
Quite right, sir. At least your wife has things in perspective. You are obviously an ignoramus of the highest order. She realized immediately, referring to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II of Great Britain.
That's right, and you must have been talking to my wife. You got the words down just right. As the Crow Flies, terrific read. Jeffrey Archer, thank you very much.
Don, thank you very much for having me on your show again.